I'm you. I'm real. I'm not a cat. This is Rock and Roll.
So hello, and welcome to the second week of our Six Nations Rock and Roll podcast. Joining me, as usual, we've got Ryan Worley. How are you doing, Will?
Yeah, not bad, mate, not bad. Quiet day at work, but apart from that, all good.
Nothing new for you there, quiet day at work. And joining us, a man who's been called Walk even more than me, but he sings a better sea shanty, host of the Scottish Rugby Podcast, Cammy Black is with us. How are you doing, Cammy?
Good evening, gents. You okay?
Yeah, very good, mate. Very good, thank you.
Better than me, I was going to say, is how you'll be doing after the weekend.
I was going to say, have you noticed how he's become more upbeat as these two wins have rolled in? I don't want to show you sort of behind the curtain and drop him in at all, and I wasn't going to mention this, but I think you got a bit carried away on Saturday because you started talking about Grand Slams as well in a group chat that we were in.
I did. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it's hard. You're talking about Ryan, are you?
I was talking about Ryan.
Who, I was getting carried away as well, you see.
I think the difference was you were on a high going into the tournament, whereas he was talking about us losing to Italy. You know, we beat two teams of 14 men, and he was talking about a Grand Slam Zoom call.
can red cards win a Grand Slam?
Well, it's working all right for us so far. People say that the PIVAC wasn't innovative enough for international level, but I think very much his new plan of only playing against 14 men is paying off. So it's something I've never seen an international coach try before, and you've got to say that it's two from two. So we'll dive straight in then, being as we've gone into it. And shall we dive straight in with the controversial one, the turning point, that moment, yeah. that red card?
Yeah. I mean, it's a red card, and there's not really any argument about that at all. I haven't got any argument about it being a red. Well, I watched it back today in a bit more detail. What's interesting is it's possibly Xander Ferguson's fault anyway, because in that ruck, you've got Stuart Hogg and Ali Price. I think Chris Harris might be there on the fringes, but you've got Stuart Hogg trying to lift a prop off the ball, and it's Scotland's attacking ruck. So Ferguson has to come in at speed to clear. Is it Wyn Jones that was over the ball, isn't it? Yeah. So he has to come in at speed and clear him off, because Stuart Hogg was doing a reasonable job, but Scotland were about to be pinged for holding on. But why he is in that position so far away from the ruck in the first place, leaving two backs in there to deal with it, is the big issue. So he's left with no option other than to come charging in. Now, you could also say that 9 times out of 10, well, probably about 15, 20 times a game of rugby, that happens, is you've got a forward coming in at pace, clearing somebody out over the ball, and he's got caught, and fair play. But the number of times, I mean, even in that game, there were other times from both sides, and you know, that Scotland did it as well. I think Alan Wyn-Jones caught one at one point, possibly off Hamish Watson, I think. You're not going to get pulled up for it. And when you watch it back, he clips the head. But he's coming in at pace and when you're coming in at pace, you've got no control, and there's no intent. He's not aiming for the head, but when you're coming in recklessly, there's that risk that you are going to hit the head. You are going to come in wrong. So it was a red card, but you know, the red card happened because Scotland had no forwards at that ruck and had no forwards anywhere near that ruck. So they've only got themselves to blame. Now, Xander Ferguson is one of the players that arrives at rucks for Scotland, attacking rucks repeatedly. So he's probably just found himself out of position.
Yeah, I completely agree. There's no intent at all. He hasn't come in there. And I know his arm position isn't great, but obviously he's coming in to sort of give him a bit. And like you say, you see it so many times that if we're going by the letter of the law, the ruck, we'd never complete the ruck. Every one of them's a penalty, because there's always someone coming. No one's coming in, binding on and clearing a player out. No player jackling that ball, even when they get the penalty, are always on their feet. I think there's always someone infringing somewhere at the ruck. It is nice to see them being consistent on it, at least, because it is similar to the Peter Omani one. And apparently they were all told before the tournament started that this was the area they were going to clamp down on, which is understandable with it being sort of the showpiece and with everything going on around the game at the minute and the legal battle that's about to commence. So it is at least nice to see them being consistent
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, the difference with the Peter Romani one, I think, is that he does come in a lot faster and he comes in a lot higher, and it's a bit more reckless. It'd be interesting to see what happens to the hearings Tuesday night. So we're delaying our podcast by now, so we're kind of interested to talk about it after the actual hearing itself. So I think with Peter Romani, they went in at 6 weeks, which is the midpoint. And I think it depends what offence they go with, but I think they'll go with charging at a rook, which seems to be what they went with Peter Romani, rather than contact with the head. So potentially, if he's lucky, they go in at the lower entry for Xander Ferguson. Yeah, he's clipped the head, but they could go at 2 weeks, which is the low entry. 50% off for good behaviour. Glasgow Warriors have got a game at the weekend, and all of a sudden he's starting against France. So I don't know. I'm being slightly optimistic there, but I think there's probably an argument for it going in at the lower end for Xander Ferguson over the Peter Romani one, and maybe not looking at that too bad a ban. Maybe
worst case, can they not use this new bullshit thing a team seem to be using, where you just arrange friendlies midweek to clear that ban out of the way?
Well, yeah, if the Glasgow Ulster game gets cancelled, then that's what we'll do. We'll just have another Edinburgh Glasgow A game, where
just chuck one on a Saturday, one on a Tuesday, one on a Thursday, and then he's back for fun.
does he do charity work at all? Because that'll help as well.
He used to be a choir boy, so I think that entitles him to 75% off the tariff.
Okay,
I'll Photoshop another one, because I done one for Johnny the other week, didn't I,
Jamie Ritchie, wasn't it?
So I'll do one that he can put on his Instagram, because that's the new in on Vogue as well, to make it look like you're innocent.
He also plays, I think he plays bassoon or something, Xander Ferguson. And his brother plays something ridiculous like the piccolo, right? And it's not Matt Ferguson, but they've got this younger brother who's like massive. And I think he's a teenager. I think he's possibly a rugby player as well. I don't know whether he's a prospect for the future. I don't know much about him other than that he's younger and he plays the piccolo, and I've seen pictures of him and he's absolutely massive. So this massive lad going around playing something ridiculous like a piccolo.
This is how players' names get misconstrued, is with rumours like these, where they thought that they're big fan, their fathers were big fans of folk singers and bassoon players and all other kinds of instruments. You've got to be careful of these rumours. Hamish Watson, a little bit fiery in his press conference after, what he called it, rubbish, and he since backtracked and said that player safety is obviously paramount. How do we feel about that one first?
I think, and it's not just him, it's Warburton as well, because they both come out and apologised and said that what they'd said initially was incorrect and they shouldn't have said what they did, and they backtracked on their comments. At the end of the day, I just think it's him in the press conference after a game, after a test match that they're trying to win, after a test match that they probably could have and should have won. And it's just the emotions of it. I think obviously in hindsight, he's looked back and realised that what he said was incorrect. It's the same with Warburton. Live on the commentary, he turned around and said that it's a rugby incident and he thinks it's harsh. And then on the highlight show yesterday, he apologised and obviously said, no, I was wrong, I watched it back, and it is a red card. So it's just the emotion of it. Both players wanted their team to win, obviously, and it's just the way it goes, I think.
I think the interesting thing with Hamish Watson, he's not actually asked, was it a red card? The question he gets asked is, are you all going to gather around Xander Ferguson now? So, I mean, his media training brain kicks in and he says, yeah, all the boys are going to gather around Xander and we'll give him he's a big lad, he can cope, he'll be fine, kind of thing. But Anderson said, that's not rugby, that's ridiculous. And I was saying today on Twitter, and I got quite a bit of backlash from it. I know we kind of chatting about on the group chat that I'm in with you guys as well, that it's kind of refreshing to see someone speaking passionately and openly after a game like that. And yeah, he's wrong. I don't agree with him at all. It's, to the head. But I think some of the reaction, and I know it's mainly come from down in Wales, and I think Wales Online have played their part in that in the way they've maybe amplified it. I don't think we should be too quick to condemn players for speaking their minds post-match, because otherwise all you're going to get is, it was a hard game today and the boys did well. And how many times do we hear it and think, well, what, that doesn't tell us anything. So it was actually nice to hear a player speaking passionately after a game. And yeah, we don't agree with him, and that's fine. He's come out and he's said, I got it wrong. What I'd rather have had him say today is, it was the heat of the post-match. I think, you know, he's taken ownership of it, but I think he also maybe needed to take a little bit of ownership of how he was feeling at the time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I was a bit upset at the time, and that's how I felt at that time. But actually, you know, in reflection, no, I'm not going to do that. My worry is now, I don't think Hamish Watson will give the same post-match reactions now. I don't think he'll be stuck up for post-match for a couple of weeks now by the SRU. I think he'll probably be sent on some sort of refresher course for post-match interviews. But yeah, I don't know what people want. What's the alternative? And the alternative is, and you know, the SRU are notoriously closed off when it comes to media access. And that's an open kind of secret in Scotland that they control it very closely at Murrayfield. And you're heading to a point where you're going to have nothing but media-controlled sports teams. You see that, you know, when Newcastle United did it. And you've got to ask, is that something we want? Do we want just, you know, the lines being peddled out at the end of the match and that's all the journalists have got to report? And I think it'd be a shame if we did. So I think it's fine to disagree with Hamish Watson's post-match comments. I'm uncomfortable with him being condemned for them in the way that he has been, with people saying he should be banned because he criticised the referee. I don't think that's a route we want to go down.
No.
And again, it's another one of these typical bullshit rugby values. He's can't criticise. Like, he's unhappy with it. I think he's right to, you know, he's got an opinion. He's fine to hear that opinion. He's not the first player who's come out and said it. And, you know, he's certainly less explosive than the Liam Williams one on the pitch. So I know people did come out and condemn him, and I was one of the ones who said, you know, that you can't say the way that he said it, especially. But I don't remember Wales Online calling for bans, or I don't remember people in Wales calling for extra bans and extra weeks for Liam Williams saying it. It was just, you know, a bit of a silly boy was he said that for. There does seem to be a bit of a gap as well between us as supporters and the steps that rugby want to be making and where some of the players are with regards to head injuries, which I think is going to could cause a little bit of trouble further down the line, because they seem to be a little bit more laid back about it. They sort of are worried about that contact and then losing the game, perhaps.
I think that comes down to, I think, Cammy, you made a point, I think, today on Twitter about, obviously, if Ferguson gets sent off, but Wyn Jones, does he necessarily need to have a HIA? Because that's probably something we need to look at, because although we may not have effects there and then, potentially he needs to have one to check just in case, because we don't know what's going to happen 10 minutes into the game, 15 minutes tomorrow, etc. It's a good point you made earlier.
Yeah, I mean, it was on our Scottish Rugby blog account, so it was Rory that tweeted it, and he was just kind of asking, is that something we should do? I know Josh from Blood and Mud was saying he didn't necessarily agree with it. You're probably right. I think it probably is something that needs to be looked at. But it's where do you stop, I suppose. If it's head on head or arm to head and it's a big hit, I think you probably are looking at someone going and having an HIA. And it doesn't, maybe what we need to have like an HIA, a lighter HIA, where they don't have to go actually leave the pitch and go to the changing room and have the full kind of baseline tests that they would have, but just maybe a kind of, right, you need to have 2 minutes at the sidelines with the doctor just to kind of do almost the pre-HIA. Like, is there anything of concern that would lead you to do that, to take him down the tunnel? It needs some sort of review, I think, if there is head contact. Because if we are protecting players, then and there's any contact with the head, then it needs to be double checked. Mm. I think the other thing, like you were saying, Grant, the other issue, I suppose, with it is protecting players from themselves. And I think it's interesting that Sam Warburton and Hamish Watson, who said that's, you know, that's not rugby and it shouldn't be a red card offence. You think about what they do with their bodies. You think about the positions they get themselves into. That's their bread and butter, is that kind of play. And getting themselves in those positions, they almost revel in it. That's something they love to do. And I think that there is an element of they need to be saved from themselves sometimes.
They say Warburton made a career of it, essentially, was that the one thing that he was known for was his ability to put his body on the line and get into positions that were. But Pocock, I remember, training in a bloody gymnastics gym so that he could build his flexibility so he could bend himself into shapes to play the ball. So, yeah, it is a bit with Sam coming. But then you look at Sam as well, and he's a broken man when you watch, watch that documentary on the BBC, and he can't walk down three steps from the broadcasting bus because his body's so battered. So it's one of those, when it is, I say, sort of, where do you draw the line? What becomes, it's not an easy problem to solve. We all know what the issues are. It's how we solve those issues that are the major thing. I don't subscribe either to the bring back Rucking. I see how it's going to change anything. To go, let's do like we did in the '80s when everyone couldn't get themselves into those positions anyway. Well, there's been a few run-ins with ex-players from bygone eras over the past couple of weeks.
I don't know how you, I don't think there's any a problem necessarily that needs to be solved at the minute, other than it needs to be policed better. And that's, you know, the whichever way you try to solve it, and I can't remember who it was, somebody posted an article where there was an ex-coach talking about this, and you look at any which way you look at it, that it changes the game fundamentally. Actually, probably what we've got at the minute is the closest you're going to get to, you know, something workable within the game where there is competition at the breakdown. I mean, maybe the only thing I was thinking today is, do you limit the number of people in a ruck? Is the only potential thing I think you could do, but I don't know whether that then leaves players more exposed.
Mm.
I don't know whether as well referees have just got to be a little bit quicker on that call. That if there's a player on that ball and their hands are on it and they're trying to pick it up,
then you can,
before someone comes in, or you stop that player coming in saying you've lost it.
It's gone. Yeah, I'm pleased you've said that. So we can straight away agree that that should have been a penalty at the dying minutes with Chris Harris over the ball.
Yeah.
This is the thing. The number of times on Saturday and again, both teams, it's not like the ref is giving one where there's a player on the ball and he's given them 4 or 5 seconds before then saying, no, you've been cleared out. Well, yeah, because he's been under that ball for so long that I've not been able to rip it out of his gut. And maybe it's not 4 or 5 seconds, but it's certainly, you know, longer it feels that way when you're sort of watching a game or if you're the player over that ball. So maybe referees have just got to be a little bit quicker on calling that, because if either calls Wyn Jones there as he's won it, or you've got to move away from that, he doesn't need to come in to clear that player out, because either you've secured possession or you've lost possession. So by coming in and dropping your shoulder to clear that man out. But it is a fine line, because a lot of rugby's built on cheating as far as I'm concerned. And so slowing that ball down at the ruck is a major part of that game. Like, it's about the only thing I can do well when I'm playing. So
I sway back and forth on it, because I think I agree. I think for a neutral or a non-rugby fan, what they need is consistency in officiating so they can understand the game. But I think part of the joy of rugby for me is that teams have to adapt. So no two games are the same, because you have to adapt to how the referees officiate in the breakdown and officiate in the scrum. And I think therein lies the challenge for coaches and players, that the team that generally wins is the team that adapts quickest to the referee on the day. And referees are changeable. I remember that the 2018 Calcutta Cup, you know, John Barkley post-match saying, we've never had Nigel Owens officiate the breakdown like that. And he was basically letting us go over the ball and Jacqueline turn England over. And we realised we could do that within the first 5 minutes. So it was pretty much open season for them. But the way they'd prepared was, well, Nigel Owens doesn't let you do that. You have to be very quick, and if you're not over the ball, then he's not going to let you do it. So for me, that's part of the interest in rugby. But I completely understand from a neutral's point of view, it must be maddening, kind of, I think I've got a hang of rugby, and then the next match comes along and your referee's just completely interpreting everything completely different.
Well, it's the same ref. Like, it's bad enough that it changes from referee to referee, and I'll come on to something else again later. But then when it's the same ref who can't make the bloody mind up, then as you go into that game, going, and it is literally changing game to game. And so Wales have always been really poor at adapting to referees, and it's where we struggled against Ireland all the time, because we couldn't get a grasp on how a breakdown is being refereed. And so we've gone into games, and then you know within 10 minutes either we're going to win or lose this. The other interesting thing, or I would even say the most interesting thing to come out of the Watson press conference, was to say it wasn't the red card that won or lost the game. It was Scotland's response just before and just after half-time. What's your feelings on that?
Do you want to go with that, Ryan?
Yeah. I'm going to be probably ridiculed for this, and because I pretty much was last week, but we played a lot better on Saturday than I thought we were going to, looking at the teams going into it, and played a lot better than the first week. but it's the second week running where we played against 14 men, and in my opinion, we should have lost. I thought both games, Ireland and Scotland were better than us. I thought though that time where obviously it's a massive, massive call. It's the right call where the ball's been just under the post. Where is it? Cummins has gone over, but he's blocked or he's the blocker, That's a massive point because we get a penalty there, and then pretty much soon after, obviously, I think Hogg mentioned it. Was it something like four penalties on the bounce we got from that moment? Whereas this, then we end up in your half. Obviously, we get the roll, in more, which we then score from to get Liam Williams's try, and then straight after we get Wyn Jones's try, and then soon after, obviously after Hogg's try, then it's the red card. So it's just a case of I think. Is a massive midpoint of the game, either side of half time is massive, but I think we've got away with another one because I don't think we deserved that win on Saturday. And I don't know what your thoughts are.
I think I have to agree with Hamish Watson. I think that Scotland at 17-3 switched off, and Scotland aren't going to become a top class team until they develop a ruthless streak. And Wales were there to be put to the sword. And it's, you know, I don't like to land it all with one player, but Gary Graham, you know, gave away three penalties on Saturday. And it's the highest. I think it's him and Xander Ferguson were both on three penalties. Now, one of Xander's is at scrum time. So I kind of always chalk those ones off because I'm never quite sure whose fault it is in the scrum. But I think with Gary Graham, that's pretty poor given how well Scotland have done defensively. Matt Ferguson gave away an early penalty, but he didn't give away any more because he kind of adapted to how the referee was reading things. But it really did give Wales a lot of confidence. But if you look at it, you think, well, you know, what is it? The last Welsh try is like, what, 68 minutes?
Yeah.
And then nobody scores any more points after that for the next 12 minutes. So 14 men, and I think Scotland were pretty much in possession for those last 12 minutes with 14 men. And you kept us within the kind of halfway and the 10-metre line. But there was a couple of moments where, like that, the Ali Price kick to nothing, which at the time I had my head in the hands and I didn't know what he was doing, but I haven't watched it back. There was a lot of space between Liam Williams and Lewis Rees-Sammet there that he'd spotted. But unfortunately, the ball bounces up when it hits the ground. Now, if that skids out, all of a sudden we're attacking your line out in the 22. Mm. The Finn Russell grubber kick to nothing was ridiculous. But again, even that last minute, you've got the offload, a ridiculous offload to Doohan, who goes down the wing. Liam Williams knocks it backwards. Chris Harris is straight away over the ball. Again, it's a different call. We've got a penalty and it's an unusual feeling to be a Scotland fan and be in this position where we're saying, actually, we've come away in every measurable metric. I think we won the game apart from on the scoreboard. To be part of a game like that as well, like such an exciting game as well, it's quite unusual. Normally we're not normally part of those games. We're normally either well beaten or somebody has an off day against us and we happen to scrape a win. So it's strange to kind of come away from a loss and actually on reflection think there's a lot of positives there for Scotland. It's just that you can't switch off at 73 up, and that's the bottom line.
See, you talk about those measurables, and when you look at them, they're not that different, really, to the England game. You come up looking impressive, and everyone's hailing you as this. The measurables are actually very similar in terms of possession, territory, tackles. You know, your missed tackles count is still quite low. Your turnovers are low when you're turning Wales over more than you've conceded turnovers.
It's 95% passion. I think it's 95% of the tackle completion rate. Now, it's unusual. I think, and I can't think of another time where someone's probably made 95% of their tackles and lost the game.
It's 95% and still score three tries.
I know. but if you watch, Squidge's video on the England game is really interesting when we talk about Scotland's kick tennis and pinning the players back in the corners and making the back three run around a lot. Now, they didn't execute that at all well on Saturday because a lot of the kicks were going into the 22. So I think Lee Halfpenny called the mark on a couple of them. But they're out by a fraction, so I don't know what it was. Just they weren't quite kicking as well. But the kicking game definitely wasn't on. Now that might be down to Wales. It might be down that they'd watched the England game and they were definitely covering the wings much better. I don't think there was as much space behind the Welsh back three as there was against England. So I think that's probably credit to Wales that they've seen what Scotland were going to do and they've prepared for it.
I wonder as well if they were expecting this sort of Welsh defence that we've seen against Ireland and seen in large parts against Scotland, where they're up quickly. And especially at the moment where referees not bothering with offside lines, that they like the Yeti, like I know they exist. Obviously, they used it well early on with Ali Price's kick through for the try, which was absolutely fine. Dupont-esque, I call it. Like, was it looking up, spots the gap, and the kick is perfect. And I wonder if that's where they thought, well, we can find that space in behind because Wales are going to be up so quickly. And then, like you say, where the Wales are just adapted a little bit better and realised that at half time.
Wales looked better when Lee Halfpenny went off.
Yeah.
I thought.
That was going to be one of my questions for later on, because Wales, I think, in our back division, I don't know who starts anyway, because we look better as well when our halfbacks changed. I thought Hardy and Sheed, you look more like pivot players. And then that back three, if you've got Josh Adams coming back in there now that he's saved his gender party camp, coming back in there, you've got Josh Adams, Liam Williams, Louis Samet seem a bit more pivot like. And then I don't know, you go in the centre. I don't know, like Willis Arholo, I thought looked absolutely superb when he came on. He didn't stop talking defensively. There's one point where he's bossing Tips and Faletau around to tell him where he wants him around the ruck, and he's screaming and pointing. And I said, it looks more like he's got like 48 caps than 48 hours in camp. Absolutely superb. So for Wales, like, we've got a back division, and I think the one that finished, save for not having enough fit centres and a centre on the wing, the one that finished perhaps looked a bit more Pivac-esque as well and seemed to execute Pivac's plan a bit better. I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, I actually did, when there was a question, Matthew Southcombe actually had a question, had a question on Twitter earlier on, and I actually answered it about an hour before we started recording. So it was, who would you pick as the back line for the England game? And I've gone who I think, if everyone's fit, who I would go with. So if everyone's fit, I chose Halfpenny, Louis Rees-Sammet, Foxy if he's fit at 13, Willis Alaholo 12, George North at 11, Dan Bigger at 10, Gareth Davis at 9, Sheedy, Hardy, and Josh Adams on the bench, because I think Josh Adams needs to earn his place, his starting place back, maybe 20 minutes against England in Cardiff and then maybe start in Rome. That's harsh on Liam Williams, but I think the big thing, the massive thing for me for how you choose that back line is depending on who's going to be goal kicking. Because if although Sheedy's got a great record at club level, he didn't look good on Saturday. If Halfpenny's there, you can probably get away with starting Sheedy, because Halfpenny can take the kicks. But I would want either one of Bigger or Halfpenny on there, especially against a game against England where you know kicks are going to be important.
I don't think it's any surprise to anyone who knows me. I've got a bit of a love affair with Bristol, and so I've watched Sheedy quite, and he does have those games. Like, generally, he's a pretty good quick kicker and he's pretty solid, but he is prone to those games where even if he's kicking them, they don't quite look right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of those kickers who's like, it can be sometimes a bit of an ugly kicker.
Yeah.
And they're going over, but you think,
it doesn't matter, as long as they go over, it doesn't matter.
Exactly. But then sometimes he has one of those games, and he had one of those games, and whether that's nerves because he's thrown in with less than an hour gone, and you're playing a massive game on the back of a win. And I mean, Bigger, Adam May were missing the kick to touch, Halfpenny missed the conversion. So there was something weird with kicking on Saturday. I don't know why.
You scored every single Welsh try was scored after Lee Halfpenny went off the park and Willis Alaholo came on.
And so Alaholo was instrumental in quite a lot of them.
Yeah.
He's got the setup for the Liam Williams try. He's given the ball to Zamit for the chip through as well. He was superb. The question is then, would you start him? Pivac seems to like Johnny Williams. I think North will play 13 regardless.
I think whoever is in the back line, Halaholo will start 12. I think you have to. It doesn't matter who else is there because you've got options for everything else. I think he has to start 12.
But then, do you not think Halaholo on the bench covers more?
No, I think
Halaholo on the bench to come on against the tired England that you just try to chuck around, and then he covers 12, he covers 13. If you've got North to 13, that covers your wings. You've got your fullback covered. Personally, I don't think he'll start.
But no, I think you're better off having someone like Josh Adams who could play the wing fullback, or if needed be all 13, or even George North. If George North isn't spot on, and you're going to start Jonathan Davis at 13, then maybe you have someone like North on the bench. I would start him at 11. I don't think Josh Adams should start yet, but we don't get paid to pick that, do we?
No, but it's quite important to a podcast if you have an opinion on it. I think it'd be, I'd not really pay the referee as well, but we've had a discussion about that. I think Wales have been quite lucky in the pack as well. Our pack worked quite well because for all the talk of injuries and the fact we've gone through numerous sixes, the rest of our pack has been pretty settled. Like one to eight, I think, other than that six, is pretty much who we would pick anyway. So we've been quite lucky on that front.
Mm-hmm.
Any changes for Scotland, Cammy, other than if Richie's back?
I mean, Richie will be bad. I'd be surprised if Richie's not back because I think it was just a niggle. It'd be interesting what they do at 12. I thought James Lang had an all right game, actually. But the kind of 12 that he is, you could just swap him for Duncan Taylor or who offers a bit more, or even Sam Johnson. I think but Sam Johnson's not in camp at the minute. He's not played enough rugby. James Lang is fine. Do you know what I mean? That's probably his best game he's had for Scotland, and it was a good game. I don't think he's... It's hard because what you're comparing him with Cameron Redpath, and you know, but it's, you know, that it's not often a player has that kind of debut or kind of bursts on the scene like that. I mean, you look at Chris Harris. Chris Harris's first few games for Scotland were atrocious. Mm. You know, he came on against Samoa and he let it ship to try. He had that first game against Wales, where it was absolute, that was a honking game for most of Scotland. but now he's probably Scotland's best player, Chris Harris, defensively and in attack now. He offered a lot in attack, a lot in carry at the weekend. Darcy Graham, I'd keep in now. I feel really bad for Darcy Graham because on another day, the headlines are about Darcy Graham and not Louis Rees-Sammet.
Mm.
And I think, you know, the headline writers will say, oh, look, you know, Louis Rees-Sammet for the Lions. I still think Darcy Graham's in with a chance because he offers a lot in defence, and he's not given a lot of credit for that. Now, the stats show, he attempted two tackles and missed two, but actually he hit a couple of rucks, and he does, he clears out rucks, Darcy Graham. He's like 5'2" and he's wet stocking feet. and that, you know, the fact that he broke Lee Halfpenny, even though Leif Halfpenny took him in the air and then played on, it's just unbelievable. And also, you know, there's been a kind of bit off field with Darcy recently, and to come in the camp the way he has and to, you know, put in a performance like that, I really felt from having to go off. Now, I think it was the right call from a go off because, you know, sticking up the jumper and keeping the forwards, ultimately we only lost by a point. I think we would have lost by more if we dropped a forward. I don't think much changes, to be honest, for Scotland. I think that's a fairly settled side. I think it would just be a matter of who's fit, whether or not we keep Xander Ferguson. If it is just a one-match ban, which is probably an optimistic, then I think he'll come back in because he'll just use the Glasgow Ulster game as his ban. But if it's longer, you're not going to see Willem Nel on the bench because he can only take about 20. I mean, he was probably absolutely devastated. He had to play 20 minutes, to be honest. He's only in the team because he can play about 15. I mean, you know, he plays a really good 15 minutes and he comes on and he keeps the scrum going forward, but he's not playing 60, 70 minutes of rugby, Willem Nel at his age. So I don't, it'd be interesting to see who they bring in. I don't know who we've got in the squad at the minute, who's, because quite a small squad with COVID and stuff. So I don't know who they'll bring in for Xander Ferguson.
So it's bated breath for...
Simon, I get my loose heads and my tight heads mixed up and I get in trouble for it. Don't know who I'm going to say Jamie Batty or Simon Bergen, but it always escapes me which side of the scrum everybody plays in.
I think Batty's a one, so I think Bergen. I think Batty's
Bergen,
a one.
Yeah. So you're probably looking at Bergen. Pierre Schumann qualifies, and Pierre Schumann wonderfully, because of the change of the rules of residency, and extended the 3-year residency rules, Pierre Schumann qualifies in the summer, which is amazing. Absolutely delighted. It's the one upside of coronavirus is that Pierre Schumann gets to qualify for Scotland 2 years earlier.
We get the usual thinly veiled comments that we get for players qualifying on residency.
There's a prospect that he could actually qualify for Scotland play for the Lions and then get caught, then get called up for South Africa. I think there's like a window of one or two matches that could possibly happen. Because I don't think you don't get captured if you played for the Lions. So if you get caught up on the Lions tour, play for the Lions, and then South Africa could say, do you fancy play for us next week? And technically you could.
That'd be amazing.
I did see one on Twitter today, though, someone asking if Stephen Varney could play for the Lions. I was like, no, that's clearly never going to happen.
Well, I think we've possibly let one slip through our fingers in Varney because he played very well. Again, I don't want to badmouth him because I mentioned him on last week's podcast as well, but we call up Lloyd Williams. I definitely would have rather had Varney if given the choice. Yeah. It feels like a massive step back. We didn't offer him a cap, but he's doing well for Italy. And obviously him and Garbisi have played together at age grade as well. So I don't know how much better the one is making the other look because they seem to have a good understanding together. But yeah, he feels a little bit like the one who slips through the net. Although I'm a big fan of Kieran Hardy and I've mentioned a Scarlets fan. He's one of those players where every time he came off the bench, you're like, right, we're going to do something. Like when he first came through, and like Gareth Davis being an international scrum half, you'd think of him, but where they go, like Kieran Hardy's coming out, like, yes, we can take something from this game if he comes on. So, speaking of forwards as well, I was a bit panicky last week on our podcast and on Cammy's about our line out and the way that was going to go. Seemed to go quite well.
Yeah, the first one was a bit shaky, but apart from that, after that, it was pretty much level peg, and I think we nicked a couple of Scotland balls as well, didn't we?
You did. I think the one thing I would caveat that but is that Blaise Thompson went off early, and I think we had him pegged as kind of the one to challenge the Welsh line out. I don't know whether just he was doing the calls or whatever, so I think that's going to have had an impact on Scotland's line out going forward. They wouldn't have been expecting to make the change with Gary Graham that early. Having said that, like you said, you got a couple of steals and Scotland should be able to adapt to those changes. But I would have thought that might have had an impact on how well the lineup went. It's strange to think that we went from 100% to whatever, 80% or whatever it would have been within the space of a week. But that could just be credit to that. You know, maybe that's all you've done in the Welsh camp is just line out after line out after line out until it gets done.
Well, I think this is the first week since the last Six Nations or the first, like, consecutive games where we've gone in with the same hooker and same line-out options. I was reading yesterday, Wales, since last spring, so we're just looking at the autumn of that first game, had gone through four hookers and nine line-out options. So a bit unsettled. And I know Pivac, when you look at the way he's treated that Autumn Nations Cup now, seemed to treat it as like an open trial, but he was just giving anyone a game and rotating players in and out. I said, I was like choosing a fucking Tekken character.
Unless they were called Harry Randall.
Well, I don't think Harry Randall was ever going to play for us, if I'm honest, anyway. I think he was going to be English the whole time, to be fair to him. But yeah, we seem to be a bit more settled, at least in the pack, than we were at the end of the autumn.
Who have you got below? Who's kind of pushing Ken Owens then for that hooker spot?
So obviously, Elliot Dees was second choice. So he was on the bench on Saturday. Ryan Elias is the third one in the squad. You've got the likes of, What's the guy's name?
Sam Parry.
Yeah, Sam Parry at the Ospreys. What's the other guy underneath him? Because he's class.
The ones that converted.
Is it Phillips, isn't it? Certainly the latter part of the Pro 14 and then going into the Christmas period, he started as a hooker for the Ospreys quite a lot and he played quite well.
I was thinking of Dewi Lake, but it's not Dewi Lake. But although he got a call up to the squad, he's a converted blindside.
Yeah.
Yeah. We can't throw, so we've got enough problems.
But, hey, all three Scotland hookers are converted back rows. And in fact, Ross Ford was a converted back row, but I think he converted when he was like 17, so it's not as bad. But yeah, all George Turner, Fraser Brown, Stuart McInally were all back rowers in professional rugby until they converted to hooker. So we went from having nobody but Ross Ford to having... Well, now with George Turner getting a run, having three very good hookers.
Well, and Cherry, I know Cherry's been late in this, but then he's essentially your fourth choice hooker coming off a bench, and he looks...
He's 29. I mean, he's all right. He helps see out the game. He does a job. Yeah. It's good to know we've got that depth. I wouldn't I wouldn't be starting him every game, but he's certainly he's good enough.
It's nice to get them to have fourth choice and still have someone you think I'm really going to hold his own at the international level.
Yeah.
Is it Evan Phillips that you were thinking of?
That's the one, yeah. That's the one, Evan Phillips.
An interesting one for me, and you might tell me I'm talking utter shit, but for me, you know, there's a direct comparison between Pivac and where we were last year and Townsend maybe on the year before. We're on the back of 2019 and the back of the World Cup. A lot of Scottish fans seem to be quite dissenting about Townsend and where he was taking you and whether you could actually be competitive. And then last year and this year, he seemed to click. Like I said, a loss on the weekend, but it's by no means a massively you've come off the rails.
No, we can see what I can see where we're going. I can see what he's trying to do now. We had a thing on our podcast, last Six Nations. We call it the Toonsday clock. We were trying to work out at what point to midnight is the Gregor Townsend Scotland career was. But it's fine. It actually Wales now remind me more of, and this isn't meant as a kind of an insult at all, but it's Scotland under Andy Robinson. Just before Vern Cotter comes in. And that's not from a coaching point of view. I'm not comparing Pivac to Andy Robinson. It's more just the makeup of the squad. That you've got someone like Lewis Rees-Sammet is a bit like when it reminded me of when Stuart Hogg came into the Scotland squad as this young player, and he was always forced on them because of injuries. But the rest of the squad was old. And you almost feel like Wales, I think Pivac, I can see what Pivac's trying to do. What I worry for Wales is more about the personnel, that you've got quite an old squad in places. You've got Alan Wynne-Jones, and I get that. No, it's, if not Alan Wynne-Jones, then who else? Alan Wynne-Jones is probably annoyed that he's still having to play every turn up every week, during that there's nobody ready to replace him. But I think it's not just Gregor Townsend. I think we've got reasonable depth in Scotland. And some of our players moving elsewhere is helping. And I know there's the 60 cap rule in Wales. And I know Gregor Townsend has said that he likes it when players stay. But I do think that, like, for example, you know, Adam Hastings getting injured and moving to Gloucester has forced Glasgow Warriors to pick a Scottish 10 run Ross Thompson. And he's played a blinder the couple of games he's had, and he's signed a professional contract. Edinburgh all of a sudden had to stick a Scottish, young Scottish 10 in. And they weren't having to do that when they've got the person. So I don't know. I think we've got a lot of depth now in Scotland. We've got a lot of very good young players coming through. And so we're not so reliant on the same incumbents as we were maybe under kind of Andy Robinson. Scott Johnson, that's one good thing Scott Johnson actually does. He came in and he wouldn't play Kelly Brown, and he wouldn't play these older players and blooded a lot of youngsters for Vern Cotter coming in.
We did cut out John Barkley, so...
He did, for different reasons, I think. That's
the comparison for me is I'll be in the sort of Townsend, especially in the World Cup, tried that sort of idealistic way of how he felt he should play rugby. And he seems to have changed that a little bit to realise the flaws in that and adapt. And I think whether Pivac's been forced to do that, especially by getting Jenkins coming in and changing our defence a little bit, but he seems less set on this. We've got to throw the ball around with and go, well, actually, if we can look a lot on defence and get on defence right and play from there, and we're winning games with not a lot of possession. Granted, with the opposition not having a lot of players on the pitch at the same time as us as well, but he just seems to have adapted that a little bit, and it's worked for Townsend. And I've said, I think at some point it'll click with Pivac, and hopefully we're starting this year. We'll know for definite in 2 weeks.
I think the one thing I think that you've got over Scotland is you've got hard players. And I don't think we had that. And one of the things that Townsend said he did is he went and spoke to Jim Telfer after the World Cup. He probably just lives down the road from him and talked to him. And I think one of the feedback he got is the players were too soft in Scotland. They didn't have that mental toughness. And it's quite hard, I think, when you know, we're talking, what does that mean in modern rugby compared to the amateur days of mental toughness in the old days meant that you, like, to the detriment of your mental health. Like someone like Ian Milne, who played for Scotland back in the day, was one of the world's greatest props, but has suffered horrendously with mental health issues since. So what does it mean now to be a hard player and being mentally resilient, but also looking after yourself? And I think that's something that Scotland had, I think they'd almost gone the other way, that, you know, it's wonderful to look after players' mental health, but I don't think they'd necessarily done enough in building up mental resilience. which are two different things, if that makes sense. And I think that's something that Jim Telfer told them to go and work on. And it's, you know, it's hugely important when it comes to defense. You're defending a set, your own line for 10, 15 minutes at a time, phase after phase after phase. You need mental resilience. You need to be hard. And I think Wales are lucky in that I would say that a lot of your players are tough. They're hard players. So that were, it's just then a case of drilling them and getting the, you know, getting the defensive patterns right and getting everyone on board with the system.
It's one of the things that I've got down in my notes, because one of the things that's been questions of Welsh players, and I've always argued that I think it's nonsense, where people are questioned that toughness and that commitment and that passion from players. I think 2 weeks in a row now, we've seen, first of all, in the 82nd minute Tipperick or 83rd, where I was tracking back to make a tackle against the back in the Ireland game, and then that tap tackle on Van der Merwe when he's completed his arm, it slips and it looks like it's a surefire try. So I think that, hopefully that silenced a bit of doubt. So it's funny you should say that, because one of the things I was gonna bring up about our mental toughness and whether, especially you look at that sort of our goal line defence again for a second week in a row, where Scotland battered us. It was wave after wave of possession and attack, and all the territory was yours. And yeah, we conceded tries, and I mean, some of them were magical. So that Hogg try, I know Watkins sort of the try comes from Watkins making the mistake because you don't know what Hogg is going to do. Like, he's that kind of, I think if it's anyone else, he stands and he goes, right, I know where he's going. And you make that happen with Hogg, you know he can step off both feet, you know he can go, you know he can create. And so it's kind of come from a little bit of Scotland have created that, rather than it is a defensive error, but it's not as unforced as people think it is. So Scotland unlocked the defence rather than Wales being a bit. There was loads of missed tackles. I think 27 missed tackles from Wales. But it's one of those ones where I know at Saracens they used to talk about they don't care about missed tackles, because it's about that defence being up in your face, and you're going to miss tackles if you're bumping players into the position you want them in.
Yeah.
So whether that's it, and they say Scotland, once when they opened up and you've got players like Van der Merwe, Finn Russell, the offload before Van der Merwe breaks with Finn Russell, we've got four players on him because the offload is unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, Chris Harris is someone that always has missed tackles for Scotland, but he's like Scotland's best defensive in defence. But and it's just it's the defensive shape that Scotland have, and they throw that he's almost beyond the attack line when he's trying to tackle, so players are past him. So it counts as a missed tackle, but actually what he's done is he's kind of cut off the passing option, and he's done a lot more work to make things awkward and cut off those options. So I think missed tackles are fine, but I don't think they tell the whole story. But Scott Johnson said something like, you know, statistics are like a bikini. They only tell you so much.
I know that with the Saracens mentality of it, and Dodd, I want to, you know, particularly praise Saracens for anything if I can usually help it, but players would sort of, you'll miss that tackle because you're rushing the man back in field because you want to bump him in a little bit, or you're willing to leave him beat you because the man inside's in a better position, and then you've got a chance of winning that tackle. You put him in a position you want them in, and so that missed tackle isn't as bad as a missed tackle in a dangerous area of the field. And so by doing that blitz defence and coming up quickly, it's inevitably you're missing tackles, but it's missing them in the right areas. So
how is that defence working for Saracens this year?
Not well against Ealing Trailfinders.
Oh, okay, good.
I just wondered as well, Wally likes to talk about Lions squads and Lions bolters and Lions players he thinks he'll come into the team. So two big defensive displays, Mellon as a Lions bolter.
Mellon?
Ben's coaching place, yeah. Sean Edwards in France.
No, I don't think Mellon's going. I think Gregor will go, though. I think it's an option of him being the attack coach. It wouldn't surprise me if Farrell goes as defence coach, but I don't think Mellon will go.
I think Tandy will go as defence coach.
Yeah, that's a good shout. Very good shout.
I think Steve Tandy will go as defence coach. I think the way that Ireland are at the minute, I think the fact that Tandy's come in and turned Scotland around so quickly as well is going to be in his favour, because it was literally overnight that he was able to do that. And that's what Gatland's going to want, right? He's going to want someone that can come into camp and, you know, drill a massive squad. And well, it might not be a massive squad because the coronavirus might have to cut it down, but going to be able to very quickly convey his ideas over to a team. And I think Steve Tandy's obviously been able to do that really well with Scotland. So I think Townsend will go this time as attack coach. I think Tandy will go I'll probably leave us a bit short-handed in Scotland, but just Danny Wilson will step back into it from Glasgow Warriors. You might even get Richard Cockrell at international level helping out, which would be, I don't know, I'd really love to see that.
Imagine if I had told you 20 years ago that Richard Cockrell would be in the Scotland setup. You would have called me a madman.
The one thing I just want to just touch on, once Steph's mentioned that, because we're going to have a Lions chat, is how many do you reckon will make it, Cammy, as it stands at the minute from Scotland?
Well, Scotsman.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell because after two, I would say after last week, I would say a few. After this week, I don't know. I don't know what, it's hard to know because I don't know what Warren Gatland's looking for in this tour. Mm. We watched the 97 Lions documentary for our podcast over the summer when we had nothing else to talk about. And what's interesting is I think that offers a template for how the Lions should go to South Africa, and that's you don't play South Africa at their own game. We were talking about this on our podcast last week, weren't we? We said, you don't necessarily want to go up there and try and compete muscle for muscle. I think Darcy Graham could be in there. I mean, he's up against Chelson Colby, so it's not like he's up against anybody particularly big. People say, well, he's not good under the high ball, but he doesn't get stuck in the back three. They put him up in the defensive line because he makes his tackles. He doesn't have to be under competition for the high ball. I think Chris Harris will definitely go. I think he's probably nailed on, actually, at the minute as a starting 13, the way he's been playing the last two games. Russell at 10, for me, I don't think there's any other options at all other than Russell at 10. I know for all his flakiness, I just think I don't know who else would go. You could say Johnny Sexton, but I think he's past it. Dan Bigger, I think, will be in the squad, but I don't think he's anywhere close to Russell. Ali Price, I think, is probably looking at scrum half at the minute. I think Ali Price, and he's probably going to get your letters, I think Ali Price is as good as Antoine Dupont. I think the reason that he doesn't make the headlines is because he's not being asked to do the same things as Antoine Dupont is asked to do. So the way that France plays, everything revolves around Dupont and he's there for the offloads. That's not what Ali Price has been asked to do. If Ali Price was being asked to kind of get off the back of offloads and cover that distance on the pitch, he'd do it. But that's not the role he's been given to do. But he's, he's speed from the base of the ruck. He's kicking over the top. He's got the same skills. He's just not being asked to be as flashy.
We talked about Ali Price as well last week, and I coach mini rugby, and I was trying to teach our scrum half like how to approach what I was, and technically he's the most technically sound scrum half I can find. So I put a YouTube video together of just clips because he does everything right every time, and he's technically fantastic. And I think you talked about where he sort of lost a bit of credit after having a bad game. Was that the Wales game? Did he come in another?
Yeah, it was that Wales game. He really suffered after that because he lost a lot of he just lost a lot of fitness. And I think again he kind of had a bit of a blip mentally as well, and kind of went away, sorted himself out, and kind of be a bit more honest about that coming into it. And he's maybe a bit more, he's happy. I think that's the body. He's a bit like Finn Russell. If he's happy, he plays really well.
I says, well, that sort of chance to step out of Laidlaw's shadow, where Laidlaw became a bit of a sort of a cult figure in Scotland on and off the pitch, is difficult then when you step in and people want to know sort of where Greg is.
It's hard because, I mean, Greg Laidlaw's from the Borders, so automatically he's got buy-in. But Ali Price is from King's Lynn in Norfolk.
Is George North from King's Lynn as well? Is there a secret pocket of Celtic players from King's Lynn that we've never...
He might well be.
I've never realised until now.
He might well be.
Yeah. That starting 15 of Scotland, I think, I'd be hard up, aside from James Lang and Blade Thompson, I think that they're all in contention for the Lions.
I think it's going to be how they respond now.
Yeah,
they've had that big win against England. They've lost against Wales, but it's not a bad performance loss. It's not they've shot their bolt by going a week early and beating England. It was just one of those games. So it's how they respond. And I think, like Gatland's talking about, like sort of credit in the bank. Like, you'll take those big players who've done it on a big stage, who when they've been down, they've picked themselves back up, or they've won a Grand Slam, or they've been there and done it. And that's why you'll fall on players. I mean, space is going to open up as well when you've got people like fucking Josh Adams going to gender reveal parties the year of Alliance Tour and being dropped from Wales, and now he doesn't know where. I think that's how they should do the Wales team. That's how they should decide on the back three, they shouldn't tell Josh Adams, and they have a big fucking confetti cannon, and they can put a whale shirt in it or a like luminous yellow training top, and then just fire it out, and he can know whether he's playing against England or not. So
bake it into a cake.
Ideas. They could put that on Instagram as well, and then it's got one of those bloody videos that last about 3 minutes at the start. I do.
That's it. Well, every time that I mentioned this to Steph before, every time that there's a Lions tour on, I always sort of have an interchangeable 15 myself, Cammy, and I do it after every game. And as it stands,
I'm not going through April 15. No,
I'm not going through it. I'm not going through it. But what I'm going to say is, currently in my interchangeable 15, there's six Scotland players in the 15. For if it was a first test, that's why that as it stands now for me, I'm not going to say obviously they're all going to make it by the end and they're all going to get picked. But I think if you have 6-8 on tour, that'd be great. But currently I've got 6 in my 15.
Yeah. Well,
the anti Josh Adams then, who because Adams looked like he was going to start that left wing, and I think he might have blown it now, especially when Duane's playing as well as he is. Wynn Jones for Wales.
Yeah.
Has come from abs, but not from nowhere, because he's been putting in those performances anyway. But the last two games has looked superb.
Yeah, I agree. So,
could he be our bolter?
I think so. Definitely think so.
I mean, he's still got Sutherland still playing incredibly well. You've still got Packwell, you've still got Genji, you've still got big players. But Wynn Jones has been superb. If you had to pick a player in that loose position from the first two games, he's been insanely good.
It depends who he's got. I mean, I think the thing with Warren Gatland is it's going to depend who he takes as coaches.
Yeah.
Because that's how Scotland have suffered in the past. We've had no one in the room. And that, you know, last time around, that was our fault because Gregor Townsend chose not to go. The time before, well, it was our folks who were rubbish. And why would you take any of our coaches? Basically, take a Scott Johnson on Alliance tour, which nobody wants. I'm sure Scott Johnson would want that. But it depends whether Wales are going to get somebody in the room. And I suppose that's a big question for you. Is Warren Gatland going to take someone from the Wales back room? Because what he's been, how long has he been out of the job now? Because he'll know some of these players, some of the older squad, but he's not going to necessarily be working with them week in, week out in the way that he was with Wales.
So yeah, 2019 he went, which I think was Wynn Jones. Wynn Jones was part of that.
Yeah, Wynn Jones played for it. I think
he dropped Rob Evans for him.
As it stands now, I think of that Welsh backroom staff, potentially Bobby Strigeon, because he's done the last few Lions tours, and potentially Neil Jenkins. I can't see anyone else going. I think they'll stay with Wales. So he'll have a voice there, but whether their voice are going to be loud enough for forwards, I suppose, it's a different matter, isn't it?
There's a Rupret in the room, is that it?
With his patch on. Even Jones might do a World Cup with him as well, mind, and got Wales to a semi-final, so I wouldn't rule out.
He's not going to take him if he takes Townsend as backup.
If Townsend even goes.
Yeah. Yeah, there is that.
Move on, then we'll go to England, Italy. You had a little
epiphany last week.
At the England selection last week, and said that you thought the centres were unbalanced and you didn't get it and you didn't know why they picked them. Proved right?
I think so, yeah, because I think their performance at the weekend proved that I was spot on. Also, what Matt Dawson said basically is what I had said on the pod last week, so I think he's probably a listener.
If Matt Dawson agrees with you, I'm going to say you're wrong.
Well, it's probably the only thing I've ever agreed with Matt Dawson on. But no, I just think I took it part of it from what Robbie's video, when he did the video about George Ford being the 10. And I just don't think that the three of them fit as a 10, 12, 13. And I think Baby Faz is not in form. I don't think if you were to pick 15 in form England players now, he doesn't make 15, he doesn't make 10, he doesn't make 12. I think as a balance for that back line, like we mentioned the other day, Steph, or might have even been earlier before we started recording, that England did quite well and looked quite attacking and scored a few tries at the weekend, but none of that was down to 12 and 13. There was no creativity, I don't think, that was coming from that centre partnership that's cutting holes and making them score tries. I'm going to say it, whether people listen to me as a Welshman or not, but I don't think Farrell should be in that 15 anymore. Yes, he's harsh because he's captain. It's similar situation to Sexton at Ireland, because I think giving him the captaincy, making him a 10 or making him the important player, I don't think he works for that squad. And I think going forward, it's not necessarily going to be the right thing for him to be there. And that could be a hindrance for the Lions if he was to be picked at 10 or 12, I think.
There's some bold opinions this week. So dropping Owen Farrell and Ali Price is as good as Antoine Dupont. These are some big statements.
I was going to jump in on the Ali Price comment because he is my nine at the minute.
But we'll leave Warren Gatland alone a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's your view on it, Cammy?
I mean, England just look at sea defensively. I don't think they really know what they're doing. England shouldn't be shipping 18 points to Italy, even away from home. And they were soft tries as well. I know Italy played a little bit better, but you know, there was points where they were, you know, I think Marco Vinopolo was putting people in the right position. Owen Farrell was barking orders, but nobody seemed to be listening to him. They were running backwards at points defensively. I don't really understand what England are trying to do defensively. And I don't really get the impression that the players do either. And that's a massive problem. I think the other thing they suffer from, and I think we're lucky in Wales and Scotland because we've got such a small player pool that you have to pick your best players and you don't have that option. I think Eddie Jones too often treats England like a club team. He's got his core squad. And I think England have probably always done it because they have their permanent squad, don't they? They don't kind of call up a new squad every Six Nations. They have their England elite squad and people drop in and out of it. And I think because of that, they don't pick the best players. I'm not even sure that George Ford is the best 10 in England. And we've got Marcus Smith. I don't understand why he's not had much. Has he had a cap yet for England, Marcus Smith? Or
I think he may have been capped, but I don't know.
Probably started a Barbarians game or something, or been in a Barbarians game or something. But I don't get it with England. I don't think that, you know, I don't necessarily think they play their best 15 players. And I know partly you have to kind of work with the best 15 players that meet your system. But I think what Wales and Scotland are forced to do is you have to build a system around your best players.
Mm.
So I think England, I'm not really clear what England are doing at the minute. I don't really think they know either.
That's my big thing as well. I said before this tournament started that for England, it was just a case of continuing to do what they've been doing, just tweaking it a little bit. And I think they've gone and tried to, it's like they've tried to change it, but I can't see what they're changing it to.
Mm.
I can't see what it's meant to be. They looked incredibly poor. I know they've scored a lot of points, but against a very young Italy. Some of the, like the Anthony Watson intercept breakaway try, it's not like they're creating those chances all the time. They look, I'm not saying we're going to beat England and all the thing, because I know they'll come back and bite me on the arse anyway if I did. But I'm not worried going into this England game. Like sometimes you're coming up against England where you're not firing 100% yourself and you think, oh shit, they can put 60 points on us if we don't turn up. I'm not worried about England like that at all, which now means that they're going to absolutely put 60 points on
us. But they missed 25 tackles, was it? No, they missed 15 tackles at the weekend, England.
Mm.
Which is, you know, against Italy. It's not. I think that their percentage was less than 90 for tackle completions as well.
And like you say, you sort of previously, if Italy has put that kind of points on England, it's been done in the last 20 minutes, last 15 minutes when the game's done, and England sort of switch off a bit, and Italy chuck it about, and they run two tries in late on. Yeah, they started explosive, but on the back foot, England are losing early on. You go, Jesus Christ, are things this bad? And you never thought that, okay, they're going to hang on, they're going to win this. But it made England look poor at times in a not particularly fantastic Italian, a very young Italian team.
And who knew England looked a better team without Ben Youngs at scrum half?
Nominated for player of the tournament 2020, I'll have you know. He is the second best nine in the Six Nations.
Yeah.
Shocking opinion that is.
Yeah, I missed 15 tackles, England.
Yep.
85% tackle completion rate.
I think they gave away 7 penalties on the ground as well.
Hmm.
It was a shocking performance. On the other hand, Marco Lazzaroni, I picked out for Italy as being absolutely superb. The second row just didn't stop working, even to the point of when Anthony Watson intercepted that try and broke through. He chased him right back under the post. Did not let up. And then he played the full eight. He was definitely only with sort of 5-10 minutes till he was absolutely immense for them. And he's exactly the kind of player that they need. I said last week that they just sort of needed someone to give on, grab a few players by the scruff of the neck. So if you're looking for someone to be a leader, Lazzaroni could be the one for them for the few years. Excellent. And then perhaps the only big talking point of the England game, Johnny May's try. Set Twitter alight. Nige is involved. Everyone's involved. Everyone's piling in.
Nige needs to stick to the cows.
I like Nigel. I've met Nigel. He's a good bloke. I know he takes a lot of shit. And obviously, he was sort of one of the best referees in the world when he was at his peak as well. But it did make me laugh when he went, no, it's against, you can't do it. It's against the laws, against the laws. Someone more laws in me when I don't know. Oh, Nigel, man.
It's one of these laws that you look at, you watch it and you go, you can't jump the tackler. And then you realise that they changed the law about 20 years ago.
Yeah.
It's just dangerous play now.
Dangerous play. And for me, there's no dangerous play.
No.
What he does there. I guess sort of if you're running at a player square on and you jump over him and you've got that chance of studding him in the face or kneeing him and breaking his face, then yeah, fair enough. But I don't think there's anything dangerous in that. And then you say, oh, you can dive for the line, but you can't jump for the line. Well, what's the difference between a dive and a jump?
I'm sure. It might have been the Russia game. Someone has definitely jumped over. I've seen someone jump over a ruck before and score.
Yeah.
In the last couple of years. I think the Scotland-Russia game, that might have happened.
And then someone threw in, then you can hurdle. But you can't. You just use, it's the same words. Like, I we might have to, has anyone got a number for Susie Dent? Because I think
technical, kind of technical hurdle thing. So long as you lead with a leg and your back leg's bent slightly and don't knock any over.
And then a dive, so see, for me, a jump, you would land on your feet. And then a dive, you're going to fucking dive. Like, I don't know. So for me, it's a try.
It's a try because it's allowed in the laws of the game because you're allowed to jump tackles.
Yeah.
So the noise is not dangerous.
No, the only issue I've got with it is then if the Italian winger, Esperandio, is coming across, if he fucking smashes him and puts him in the first row, who are we giving a penalty to there? Are we giving a penalty to anyone? We just see him play on? Is it because he's then taking a man in the air? This is why rugby laws are fucking stupid a lot of the time.
I think so long as it depends how he smashes him. If he smashes him safely to the ground, he's fine. Because you're allowed to take players in the air as long as you safely return them to the ground.
Yeah, and you're only in the air because you jumped in the air. It's your own fault.
Yeah. But that doesn't work when you jump for a high ball. So I think if he's holding on to the ball, but I think if he's jumping because he's holding on to the ball and he gets taken at waist height and he's this is ridiculous. This is an audio podcast. I'm doing this thing in my hand. He's horizontal, vertical. If he's kind of like, you know, coming at the side, then I think he's
as long as it would be a legal tackle if he was on his feet, we're happy to continue.
I think that'd be legal. I think if he caught him and smashed him at the waist and taken him off the pitch, I think he would have been fine. I think it would have been harsh to have given him anything. Otherwise, you're never going to stop anybody jumping for the line.
And it's completely at odds with everything I've said about rucks up until now. But I think it should be legal just purely for entertainment value because I want to see players go and try. I don't want it to be English players if I can help it. Sorry for any English listening. I don't think I've hidden my bias towards Wales very well in the past anyway. But I want to see players somersaulting over the line, jumping over a defender and scoring a try. This is fucking this box office stuff.
Show me the money. Go on, go full full Jerry Maguire now. Show me the money. If you're a showboat.
Yeah, we talk about we can't get enough people to watch the game and how boring it can be at times. Yeah. And then we're complaining because someone jumped over a player to score a try. We should be celebrating. If that was a rugby league game, we would like they'd be showing our clip for fucking weeks to come.
Rugby values.
Rugby values. Hashtag.
Rugby values is hashtag rugby values is killing the game.
So I think that's just about anything there was to talk about the England game. It's probably more than there actually was to talk about. On to Sunday, France, Ireland. All the promise, none of the delivery.
Yeah, what a letdown. What an absolute letdown. Like, it's, for me, it started quite well. I thought Ireland, and we said this earlier, without actually creating anything, they looked a bit more as though they had an idea. So there was quicker ball from the forwards. Gibson Park was quicker on the ball. He was getting the ball to Burtons. But when it got to Burtons, it's like they have that issue with Sexton, because Sexton doesn't pass past 10. Burtons may have wanted to, and the others just weren't expecting it. So there was nothing that really came. They looked just flat. It got to 15-13 as a final score. France weren't anywhere as good as they were the week before. But I also don't think, to use a phrase that was used quite a lot on our group chat, Steph, I don't think France even got into second gear, let alone anything else, for this weekend.
Yeah, I described Ireland's attack as all hat, no cattle, which is now my favourite saying that I've learned. It's got so much there, but it kind of, watching Ireland is like watching Andy Farrell play rugby union. Like, it's strong and dependable, and defensively you're not going to break it, but it doesn't offer you a hell of a lot of creativity in attack. And Ireland look brilliant going through phases. They look like they're going to get the ball, they look like they're going to do, but they don't actually create anything. Their tries come from a lineup that's misfired, gone wrong, and so plays completely broken. And nothing is a play, nothing's something creative. It's just shit. Mm. And for all the shit that people gave Wales, and you know, I said that we weren't good in the autumn. I said at the time, Ireland were even more boring and fucking useless than we were in the Autumn Nations Cup, but it was a dirge to watch. And it's not got a hell of a lot better in attack.
Yeah. I'm not worried as much as I was about playing France and Ireland in the next couple of weeks. I get why everyone's excited about France, because France have been a bit crap for a few years now, and they've got a good nine, and they've got a couple of good young tens coming through, and they've always had a good back line. But I don't buy it right now with France. I think, you know, they had that great first game, but it was against Italy. And I think in the minute, I don't think you can read much into how teams play against Italy, other than when, like England, they play badly. So for me, with France at the minute, I think that, yes, they've got some, they've probably got the best nine in the world right now, but so have we. but yeah, I don't know. I think France, you know, France are beatable. I think they, you know, their discipline's not great. I don't know, defence was fantastic at the weekend. They're very dangerous in attack, but Scotland have got a very good defence. So I'm not, again, it doesn't, I don't, I think that'll be a very close game. I'm not expecting to win it, I should say, before Johnny McGinty gets upset at me and says I'm jinxing everything again. I don't necessarily expect that we're going to win it, but I think it'll be a very close match. Mm. And I think it'll be the same with Ireland as well. I think it's going to be a close tournament, I think. I think it could be a lot of very close games in this. So, yeah.
I think what bodes well for Scotland as well is how well Ireland retained the ball. And having watched the way you've played your first two games and how solid you've looked at the breakdown and the way you've kept possession and kept territory, I think that should at least give you heart, because then behind you are creative. You have got a Finlay-Brussels-led attack coached by Andy Townsend, as opposed to a Johnny Sexton-led attack coached by Andy Farrell. I know which side I'd rather be on.
Yeah.
Plus,
I've already beaten England, so this can't come back to bite me.
Plus, can I just add that if Scotland's attack is coached by Andy Townsend, I'd be concerned, because it's Gregor.
Let's see, Andy Townsend. I was thinking of Andy Farrell. No wonder they're creative on the ball.
Yeah.
Explains those kick passes as well from Finland. obviously, I know that we will have known that an ex-Welsh international has obviously come up with Ireland's solution by picking Paddy Jackson at 10. So I know you fired a few shots back, Wall.
Absolutely, I did. I just don't understand it, to be honest, because there's lots of reasons why he can't play for Ireland. nothing to do with whatever has supposedly or and not supposedly happened previously. The reason why he can't play for Ireland is he currently plays in England and they don't pick any players that are not playing in Ireland. So that's one massive reason. Whether he plays for London Irish or not, it doesn't count. It's not in Ireland. There are other reasons, as I said in my tweet, that a lot of genuine Irish people probably wouldn't want him to play. So, and plus, I don't think he's... What would he be in the rankings? Fifth, sixth, maybe? You're probably looking at someone like Ben Healy played at 10 before him, surely.
Yeah, they've only got plenty of 10s. They don't need to be going... It's a standard thing with all ex-pros is they just go with... They always go with a named player. And I think it's just missed... On this particular occasion, it's very misjudged to name that particular player, given the reason why he left Ireland and went to play rugby elsewhere. And I think given the things that came out about that and elsewhere, I don't want to get you sued. So I'll carefully choose my words. But yeah, it's not, I don't think it's something that the IRFU would stomach or want to stomach. And I don't think he's even, I'm not even sure he's fifth or sixth. There's so many good young tens in Ireland right now. I mean, I'm not even sure why they're persisting with Johnny Sexton, to be honest.
No.
I think regardless of any verdicts that happened on the back of court cases, it opens up a box that people won't firmly fucking nailed shut.
Yeah.
Like, they've had that case and the fallout of it, and then obviously him coming back into the game caused enough problems. I think for the RFU, especially given everything that happened with Rory Best on the back of that court case, don't really want to be praising Pandora's box back open to let that fucking cat out of the bag, to use more cliches than your typical ITV journalist has used this weekend.
But, so to sum that whole thing up, Andy Powell, you're a wanker.
Well, I know a few people who know Andy Powell. He's actually been a really decent, really good guy. And I know he's got this sort of reputation in the press. And I know a few people who will generally vouch for him being a quality guy, a really good guy. But as Kami said, that's massively misjudged at the very least.
Yeah, you got to feel, I mean, you feel for people that like the proper pundits, not like us kind of people that do podcasts in our spare time, but like you've got to be constantly be making the headlines and getting the likes and the retweets and the engagements, good and bad. And I don't necessarily think that the people that employ them are bothered about whether it's good or bad. All they're bothered about is traffic a lot of the time. So there's this constant competition. I interviewed John Beattie, the BBC former Scotland, not Johnny, his dad, a while back. And he said the reason he went into commentary rather than being a pundit is because he got fed up with the competition. He said everyone's constantly fighting to make the better point. And to be controversial and say something that's going to get engagement, and he was doing it back in the 90s, and that was the case. And Rory, again, we interviewed Rory Lawson, and he was saying the thing, he shifted to commentary for the same reason, as you just said, there's always a crop of young guys coming through. And so someone like Jiffy, one, he's there because he's got he's got a reputation, but the only reason he stays there is because he will say he'll get the engagement. The only reason John Inverdale's still in the job is because he annoys and frustrates people, and people, they'll look at the measurements and go, oh, loads of people mentioned John Inverdale this weekend. And they won't look at what people are actually saying about John Inverdale, but they'll be like, oh, well, he's obviously getting engagement. Let's keep him employed. So someone like Andy Powell coming out with something like that, you wonder how much of it is, if I say that, it's going to get, I know no one else is saying that, I'll say it. And people will want to come back to me as a pundit and employ me. And I think it's misjudged, but it's worked for him.
I wonder if you'd slightly overestimating Andy Powell's intelligence as well. It is the sort of the old Howard Stern argument with the listeners, where it was, you know, the poll that comes back and they're like.
Now, the night that he drove that golf cart up the motorway, my brother was in a nightclub with him that night. My brother walked up to Gore and Gatland in that nightclub and told them they were lucky. So I think I still say to my brother, it's his fault that Andy Powell ended up in that golf cart.
Well, see, the old Howard Stern adage was the people who liked him were listening, and they're like, why'd you listen? Well, I want to hear what he says next. And they say, well, 55% of the audience hates you. And he's like, well, if they hate me, why do they listen? It's because you want to see what you say next. Yeah. And so it was like, I think that's what a lot of them do sort of get away with. The
trouble we've seen though is sort of him, Mark Ring, and Lee Jarvis seem to be the biggest one, and no one seems to be fucking employing them for their opinions anyway.
No.
Like, they're all coaching lower level rugby teams. Are they trying to get a gig? What are they fed up
with? I suppose it keeps them relevant for the after dinner gigs, I guess. That they get in, you know, then Wales Online pick it up. Andy Powell says this, you know, this player, Paddy Jackson, should be picked for Ireland. And it's, you know, it's a news story suddenly. And then, oh, Andy Powell, I know him. And then, do you know, he suddenly gets a gig at after dinner speaking circuits on at the clubs, which is probably very lucrative for him.
Especially this year, because it was obviously 12 years ago, he was on that Lions tour to South Africa, wasn't it? So it'll be another, he'd be looking for that in the summer to try and make a few quid like you should.
That's it. You'd be on all the big Lions dinners, stuff like that. And if you're current and your name's about, someone thinks, oh, I'll give him a ring, see if he's free to come and have a free, get free meal, few hundred quid.
Or as John Bentley did with ours, sleep in your car the night before, turn up and give apparently the shittest after dinner speech I've ever had. sorry, well, I think I've trampled on yours a bit by bringing up the pipe, but we'll move on to this week's winners and wankers.
Yeah, I was going to say. Speaking of wankers, Andy Powell was mine, so who's yours?
I've gone for Willis Alaholo haters, all the dickheads who came out the week before and did the whole, like, it's nice and simple. Does he consider himself Welsh? Yes, then he's Welsh.
Yeah.
Or he's not Welsh. And then if he's good enough to play and he's eligible to play, shut the fuck up and support him. So get fucked. To all those people who send shitty messages after he was announced to being called up into the squad, and what a way to silence him by having an absolutely superb performance coming off the bench. And he was brilliant and literally changed the game. Created try-scoring opportunities, defended superbly, talked all the way throughout. So, yeah, fuck the Willis at all. As they're my wankers of the week. You, Cammy?
I'm going to say this on your podcast rather than mine, because I think it'll get picked up on mine by the person who I think is a wanker. I set a tweet out afterwards saying, anybody who says we'll learn from this can get in the sea. And what I meant by that is that I just think from Scotland have been here too many times with the heartbreak and the, you know, making the wrong decisions at the wrong time and being ahead and not putting teams away. And that's what I meant is that, you know, there's a point at which you can't learn it anymore. You know, you just need to do it and get on with it rather than learning lessons. So that was the point I was making tongue in cheek. Now, some guy replied and said, well, he tweeted me. And this guy's quite prominent. He's an estate agent, and he's also the host of the official Ember Rugby podcast. And he was like, and he also hosts his own podcast, which is kind of, it's called Get After-ish. And it's all about being positive. And if you just believe in yourself, you can be anything. And he was saying, I don't think, you know, the 1 minute they're riding on the coattails of the Carl Cutter Cups, why don't you get behind the lads and just positive men? I will get in the sea any day of the week for people that are willing to learn from mistakes. And it bugged me. He then sent me a video of him jumping in the sea later on, which was an absolute psycho move. Right. I think the thing that bothers me is it's that mentality right now. I buy into the whole learning lesson stuff. Scotland worked with a guy called, I'm going to forget his name now. He's one of the big kind of sports psychologists. He's based in Manchester. I can't remember his name now, and it's going to really bug me now. But he's really impressive in the stuff that he does. I've read his books, really, and I buy into that lesson learning thing 100%. But it's hollow when it comes from someone from a public school background.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can afford to fail because you've got someone there to catch you. So I get it. I completely buy in that people can learn lessons and move on. But I think when you're posting blogs saying I've lost 12 grand on a business, but I learned from it, I moved on. There's not many people can fail with a 12 grand business and bounce back and set up their own company. So that bothered me, that the whole response to it is, let's just get behind the lads. Let's do it. Let's learn lessons that they'll bounce back from. This is like, yeah, but you know, not everybody can just bounce back. Not everybody can get through life with the power of positive thinking. Some people do have to strive quite hard for stuff as well.
Very Alan Partridge. Is it Damien Hughes? Is that the...
Damien Hughes, that's who I'm thinking about.
I'm concerned you're causing Scottish rugby fans to go full Reggie Perrin and just into the sea after games.
Yeah, massively. I'm very impressed with Damien Hughes. I recommend any of his books. They're all absolutely spot. It's all full of sports anecdotes. And he's really interesting himself because his dad was a boxing coach in Manchester. And I think he was, he kind of went down one path with his career and then he's kind of retaught himself to be like a sports psychologist and going back in education. And he's works with a lot of sports teams now. So yeah, massively recommend anything that he's written in terms of that kind of learning lessons and stuff. But I don't know, I just, people that then spout it and are evangelical about it really bother me though.
Yeah. And there was that, the one that all the Premiership players and a lot of the Bristol players were following. It's really weird. It's got like a Project Mayhem style name, something for men. That after Sinclair got suspended for telling the ref to fuck off, he put a tweet and he tagged it in there. And I remember sending it to the group with like, this is really Project Mayhem stuff. And that, it's just bizarre. Like it's almost cult-like.
It is, yeah. Yeah, 100%. It gets really culty and then you go down these weird kind of, all of a sudden it gets like linked to holistic medicine and stuff. And if you've got to be very careful, it's like you kind of got to kind of like accept it for what it is, like with some of the books and stuff, but don't keep digging, don't go into the YouTube videos behind it because it's a really slippery slope. All of a sudden you're worried about 5G reading your brain.
That's what's happening at Exeter, obviously. I think the rugby players, it must all be CBD oil and coffee because that's what all of them.
One minute you've got a sports psychologist, and the next minute everyone's walking around in tinfoil hats.
And then moving on to our winners this week. My winner came from today where I had a few in there, and I'm just going to go. Quins have launched the first LGBTQ fan. It's the first one a professional rugby team has had, first fan group, so that's my winner for this week. I'm not even going to bring up anyone else for playing well or commenting or coaching. That was my winner for
Darcy Graham. I know I've talked about it already, but I just had him written down because he hasn't played much rugby recently, and to come in and have a game like that, and I really felt from, I understand why he came off. I think it was the right decision, Bush. He was on to a man of the match performance there. He was on to kind of having all the headlines written about him with that try and some of his work. So he's my winner this week. Little wee Darcy, bless him.
And your one to round us off?
I'm going to say something.
Take a wind up for this
one. No, it is. I'm going to say something that I didn't think I was going to say in the autumn. I'm going to say Wayne Payback.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I know. Because although it's still not there, it's a lot more there than I thought it was going to be in the autumn. There's definitely been progression. We may have been, and I said this earlier on in the pod, only just beaten two teams with 14 men. But I think the fact that we've even beaten them, because in the autumn we wouldn't have even tried to come back. We wouldn't have had a look in. So yeah, for this week, it's Wayne Payback.
I'm broken him. It's all going to end in Wayne Payback being your winner of the whole tournament and your Lions team having Ryan Elias at Docker.
That will never fucking happen.
I think on that note, we'll draw it to a close. So thanks for your ask, Cammy. Brilliant having you on.
Thanks for us on.
And thank you all for yours and bowling me over with your final win. I didn't see that one coming at all.
I had two written down. My other one is the one that you nicked, so I had to put a few back in there in the end.
Cheers, both. Thanks very
Cheers,
much.
Cammy.
Cheers,
bye-bye.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Rock and Roll in association with Health and Adversity, tackling mental health together.